We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us for this second hour of the show. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Back in the 1960s, it was feared that, perhaps within a decade, more than 20 nations around the world could have nuclear weapons. The fact that today only 9 countries do have them can in part be traced to the willingness of most of the world to commit to non-proliferation. At the same time, there is a thriving black market in nuclear technology. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with David Albright. He is the founder of one of the world's leading organizations investigating the spread of nuclear weapons. And he is joining us this morning to talk about a book that he's authored that's just out recently. The title of his book is Peddling Peril: How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. It is published by the Free Press, and it's just recently out. So if you're interested in finding it in the bookstore, I'm sure that you can do that. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. David Albright is a physicist. He's also president of the Institute for Science and International Security, ISIS, in Washington, D.C., and he directs the project work of ISIS. In addition, he regularly publishes and conducts scientific research, and he's written a number of assessments dealing with secret nuclear weapons programs throughout the world. He has been cited often in the media, appeared frequently on television and radio. He's testified many times on nuclear issues before the U.S. Congress. Before founding ISIS, he worked as a senior staff scientist at the Federation of American Scientists and as a member of the research staff of Princeton University's Center for Energy and Environmental Studies. He's also taught physics at George Mason University in Virginia. He is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in is that they try to be brief so that we can move along and get in as many callers as possible. But certainly, your questions are welcome. You may call us at 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that second one. And then we also would be happy to have email comments as well. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. That's the address. And Mr. Albright, hello. Thank you for talking with us.
Hi, how are you? Good to be here.
Good. Thanks very much. And we appreciate you being here. I thought maybe it just might be interesting to, as you begin your book and as I began with a brief introduction, to elaborate just a little bit on the fact that if one wants to draw maybe some small encouragement, you can look at indeed the fact that if we go back a few decades, there was a real fear that there could be many countries around the world that had nuclear weapons. And fortunately, and for some reasons we can discuss, I'm sure, that it hasn't turned out to be as bad as people at that time thought.
That's right. And you mentioned it, in the 60s there was real worry that maybe 20 more countries would get nuclear weapons. At that point in time, there were only about 5 that had managed, and they were all, most were developed states, Britain, France, United States, Soviet Union. I mean, the newcomer that first scared people was China. Like, how did China do it? It wasn't that developed. It was in the midst of all kinds of internal turmoil, and yet it managed to get detonate a nuclear weapon in 1964. And the answer turned out to be the reason they succeeded, really, is because they had quite a bit of help from the Soviet Union in the 50s. Now, the Soviet Union changed its mind and pulled out, but by that time they'd already provided enough so China could finish the job. And so that said to the international community that maybe it's not so hard to do this, and that maybe there, you know, it's, and others will help. And then if you look at countries like Germany, Japan, Italy, I mean, they all had their reasons to get nuclear weapons. They feared the Soviet Union. And so there was a major effort launched in the late 60s, principally by the United States and the Soviet Union, to try to keep all these countries from building nuclear weapons. And their major tool was the Non-Proliferation Treaty, where countries would, who didn't have them by a certain date, 1968, would agree not to get them. And they also, they did something which worked at the time and still works, which is they offered security umbrellas to their closest allies and tried to lock down the ambitions of those countries so that they would not build nuclear weapons, but they would feel that they would be protected if they were attacked by a country with nuclear weapons. So you had NATO being formalized, and in that context of the NPT, NATO, countries like Germany, Italy, gave up their ambitions for nuclear weapons, and since then have become deeply committed against nuclear weapons. And so you had a situation where many of these countries that had originally thought about getting them gave up that ambition and then decided that that's the better way to go. And as the Cold War ended, Germany emerged as a very strong supporter against proliferation. And despite its lack of need for a security umbrella, and in the sense that it could revisit the question if it wanted, it feels that nuclear weapons are definitely not in its interest, and in fact is a major proponent of nuclear disarmament now worldwide. Mm.
That seems to me to be an important and maybe not often made point, that when you ask this question, well, why aren't there more nuclear nations? On one answer is, well, you know, actually, as it turns out, building nuclear weapons is difficult and it's expensive. But that beyond that point, many nations also look at that question and they say, well, perhaps actually having nuclear weapons is not going to make us more secure. It might even make us less so. So if you ask this question, what sort of things can we do to limit proliferation, controls on technology and materials, that's one thing. But another important angle would be for those nations that express interest in or have made moves toward nuclear weapons, can you make an argument to them? Can you persuade them that there are actually good reasons, good security reasons, for them not to?
No, you can. I mean, at ISIS, we've charted maybe 30 countries that have tried to get nuclear weapons, or in one case, South Africa got them and gave them up. And so, you know, there's been many that have tried. And yet we only have 9 now with nuclear weapons. And so a key part of the argument for these countries to constrain themselves has been that they'll be safer without nuclear weapons than they are with. Where the international community has failed is that it hasn't really rewarded these countries. I mean, South Africa had a pretty sophisticated nuclear weapons arsenal in the late 80s when it gave it up. It was planning to start a project to put nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles, and it got almost nothing in return for giving up its weapons, and if you look at a country like Brazil, they gave up secret nuclear programs. At the time, they were thinking of peaceful nuclear explosives. They weren't thinking so much of weapons. They didn't really have an enemy, but they saw nuclear weapons as helping their prestige. And also helping a competition they were having with Argentina on nuclear things. They gave up their ambition for these peaceful nuclear explosives, signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They also don't get much and haven't gotten much. So you have there is an asymmetry that in a certain sense, you know, the bad guys get rewarded and the good guys don't. And so it's a problem in the international non-proliferation regime that we need to straighten out. And perhaps the greatest example of where bad guys get rewarded is North Korea, where they were in the 1990s offered 2 large commercial nuclear reactors if they froze their nuclear program and moved toward elimination of the more problematic parts. And all that fell apart, but still there's an incentive internationally to reward, in a sense, the cheaters, the bad actors. And we're not doing enough to reward the good actors to reinforce their willingness to impose constraints on themselves.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest, David Albright. He is the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security. It's one of the most respected organizations that work to monitor nuclear proliferation. He's the author of a recently published book that's titled Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. It's published by Free Press, out in the bookstores now. You have questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think probably if you were going to create some kind of special award to give to the individual who more than any other person had been responsible for proliferation over the last couple of decades, it's very clear that the man who get the award would be A.Q. Khan. This man who is known as the father of the Pakistani bomb, who is for that is very highly regarded in his country, is a man that when you discuss him is often referred to as, you know, something like Pakistani nuclear scientist, something like that. I think that may be giving him slightly too much credit. His story, it's interesting in that he seemed to be somebody who was maybe more than anything else an opportunist who was in the position to steal some technical information that he then brought home to Pakistan that made it possible for them to develop their bomb. And so it's an interesting case, and maybe one of the central case that you discuss in the book.
No, that's right. And A.Q. Khan is sort of the proliferator of the century, of the 20th century, and hopefully, you know, he'll be the major proliferator of this century, although we don't know yet, obviously. He went to Europe from Pakistan in the 60s to get an advanced education, get a university degree, get a PhD. He married a Dutch woman and settled in the Netherlands and got a job working in a very secret uranium enrichment program. It used gas centrifuges, which Europeans were developing as kind of an innovative way to enrich uranium, and they were planning to commercialize it. And the Dutch, the Germans, and British had pooled their resources, feeling each alone couldn't do it, and were moving ahead, developing this machine. And Khan was working as a contractor to the Dutch enrichment program, and ended up getting access to essentially all the secrets that this enrichment consortium had. And he was becoming increasingly concerned about India's progress on nuclear weapons, worried about India's dismemberment of Pakistan, splitting off West Pakistan, which became Bangladesh. And so he decided to work on getting Pakistan's nuclear weapons. And he took back this technology, a lot of secret designs, but he also had started creating a supply network in Europe because Pakistan couldn't build anything significant or technological. And they had to go out and buy things for the centrifuge plant. And they were able to exploit a loophole in the nonproliferation regime. People had assumed that, you know, a country would try to buy a plant to separate plutonium for weapons or buy an enrichment plant. And so there had been efforts to ban those kinds of sales or limit those kinds of sales that were developing in the 70s. And the U.S. was a leader of that effort. But people hadn't thought that someone could buy an enrichment plant piecemeal. And so Khan was able to work for several years undetected, buying things up in Europe. And the suppliers were, you know, some of them knew it was for a gas centrifuge plant in Pakistan, but were more interested in the money, and certainly were not telling their governments that this was going on. And so he had a big head start exploiting this loophole and ended up successfully building this enrichment plant with all the help of these suppliers in Europe and elsewhere, and it ultimately got help from China, or Pakistan got help from China on the nuclear weapon itself in the early 80s, because they also didn't know how to do that effectively. And then between these two sources, European centrifuge technology and suppliers, the Chinese, Pakistan ended up with a nuclear weapon by the mid-80s. But it was interesting. I mean, there's a little bit to be said that if you go out and steal things, you acquire things internationally, people give you things for your nuclear weapons program, your limit to then turning around and doing the same thing are very low. And that's indeed what Khan and his associates did starting in the mid-80s. They just started offering help to other countries. And a lot of it was for money, although there were probably some ideological reasons, too. And if you look at who Khan helped, it tended to be other Muslim countries. And But there were other cases. You know, Kahn's people offered help to South Africa in the late 80s, and that really was financial. There was help to offer to Iraq in 1990, right after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. And that, you have to think, is maybe it's ideological on the part of Kahn that he doesn't like the United States. But at the same time, they probably thought it was, you know, a desperate country that may be willing to pay money. It didn't work out in the end, but nonetheless, it showed that Kahn was out there seeking customers, and his barriers to making these offers was pretty low.
We have a couple of callers here, and I want to start to bring them into the conversation. We'll just start right in. We have someone on a cell phone, so I want to get to them on our line one right here. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to say first that I hope this didn't come off wrong, because I completely support getting rid of nuclear weapons. And I understand that cleaning up the mess after the fact would be a risky enterprise, but on the idea of rewarding good actors, you know, and bad actors, can't we look at it like the good actors, their reward is basically avoiding the costs of building and maintaining and potentially getting rid of these things, whereas the bad actors are kind of being fed a poison pill of their own making. I'll hang up and listen to what he has to say. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, and that's been the theory. South Africa gave up these nuclear weapons, and its reward was rejoining the international community and offsetting some costs. South Africa responded and said, yes, that's fine, but the costs weren't that great when you really get down to it. And that what they perceived was just something that was unfair. And this is in 93, 94. Why did North Korea get what amounted to about several billion-dollar offer to give up, actually less than what South Africa gave up? So I think what it really raises is it's an issue of fairness. Now, I personally supported grudgingly the offer to North Korea in the early 90s. What I would say needs to be done is we have to find a way to also reward those who do the right thing. And South Africa could have used a couple $1 billion from the international community in the early 90s to help the transition to democracy and black rule. And so there were a lot of hungry people, a lot of real programs desperate, social development programs desperate for money that could have used an infusion of cash at that point in time. And so really it comes down to that it's a question of fairness. And if you're going to reward kind of the bad actors and the cheaters, you should also reward the good actors.
All right, let's go to another caller here on our toll-free line in Naperville. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I was curious, do you think there's I know this is kind of a weird question, but do you think that we're on the verge of a nuclear war with Iran and North Korea?
Yeah, I don't think we're on the verge. Let me treat each separately and then give some background. I mean, I think in the 50s and 60s, we were on the verge of a nuclear war with the Soviet Union that could have kind of ended civilization as we know it. And so I don't think we're facing anything like that right now. But what we're facing, and unfortunately, I think it could be that the probability of a nuclear weapon going off somewhere in the world may be increasing. I mean, you can't prove it, but in the nonproliferation community, you have several situations that are unsettling. One is you have what's going on between India and Pakistan. They keep increasing their arsenals. They're not settling their political differences. This recent terrorist attack in Mumbai, killing so many people, and it's linked to Pakistan. I mean, thank God India is a country of restraint. I mean, can you imagine if terrorists in Mexico, supported by the Mexican government, attacked a hotel in Chicago and killed 200 people, would the United States not respond against Mexico? It's pretty hard to believe that. And if India had responded against Pakistan militarily, it could have ended up in a nuclear exchange. And that was part of India's response or restraint. But it also, India is trying to this current government is trying to minimize some of the potential flashpoints with Pakistan. But it's unusual for that to happen, I guess is my point. So you have problems in India and Pakistan that could lead to a nuclear exchange, and the probability of that exchange, I don't think, is going down. You raised the question of, first, North Korea. North Korea, thank God, is surrounded by very strong states, China, Russia, Japan, South Korea. There are military alliances between the United States and South Korea that confront North Korea. So I think that the chance of North Korea using a nuclear weapon are pretty low, and that North Korea's engaged in an effort to kind of strengthen itself with nuclear weapons and create a deterrent, because mostly it's worried about being attacked. It's also potentially interested in selling off those nuclear weapons. In Iran, they don't have nuclear weapons now. I don't think they've made a decision to build nuclear weapons yet, but they're developing the capability to do them and essentially have reached that capability. If they decided to build nuclear weapons now, they could probably do it. It may take some time, but they could end up with a warhead on a ballistic missile. Now, that scares the Israelis in the United States, because is this regime responsible? Will it truly be deterred, or will it become more adventuresome with nuclear weapons? I mean, there's signs both ways. But the bottom line is that people worry that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, it could trigger a military confrontation. And if you have a country like Israel worried about its existence, it could actually trigger a nuclear exchange. And so so you do have to worry, I think, more in the Middle East context that indeed we could be heading for the detonation of a nuclear weapon if we're not extremely careful, and particularly try to keep Iran from achieving that capability or achieving nuclear weapons. The last thing where you have to worry about is nuclear terrorism. That we've all heard stories that physical protection of plutonium, highly enriched uranium in the former Soviet Union has not been adequate, and maybe some has been diverted already and is just hidden away or in the home of a nuclear scientist. Terrorists are probably not going to be able to make an enrichment plant to enrich uranium to weapon grade or somehow get a reactor and get plutonium, but they may be able to steal it or buy it. And so you have to worry that if a terrorist group gets that material, they'll be able to fashion a nuclear weapon. And it's unclear what they'll do, but probably they're not going to try to use it for deterrence. They're probably going to try to use it to have a huge dramatic action that'll help their cause. And so we're, unfortunately, one of the major targets for many of the known terrorist groups, and so we still have to worry about a nuclear weapon going off here.
Yeah, that seems to be the scenario that's more frightening. Certainly there are reasons to be concerned about states developing nuclear programs, but as you've explained, that even though it's expensive and difficult, if you have the appropriate level of technology and you decide you're going to allocate the resources that way, you can do it. Non-state groups, it's not likely they're going to be able to build their own weapons, but if they have the resources, it would be conceivable that they, as you say, either could get their hands on some nuclear material or a completed device and not have to go through all the problems involved in building one. They could just buy one, and certainly there are plenty of them around. So that's the thing I think that seems to scare people.
Yeah, and I think the part that is probably the more likely is getting the nuclear explosive material, plutonium or highly enriched uranium, and then fashioning a nuclear explosive device. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of debate over since 9/11 and the overthrow of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Could terrorists build a nuclear weapon if they had plutonium or highly enriched uranium? And I think the debate has been converging that, unfortunately, that yes, they can. It's not going to look like a weapon a state would build, which wants, predictable explosive yield, reliability. A terrorist group may say, well, if it's a 20% chance it works and it's made out of plutonium, that's great. It may fire at a very low yield relative to what a state would get, but fires at even at that low yield, it'll kill thousands of people if it's detonated in New York, for example, or even tens of thousands. It'll be probably a device that's simpler. They'll probably even look for shortcuts. And one of the things, unfortunately, we also learned after the Taliban were overthrown in Afghanistan is that al-Qaeda was looking at developing nuclear weapons. And they'd done the smart thing. They sought out help from Pakistani nuclear scientists. It wasn't AQ Khan, but it was kind of competitors of AQ Khan in the nuclear program. Ironically, the lead guy was a guy named Mahmoud, Dr. Mahmoud. He had actually been the first head of the gas centrifuge program when Kahn was still in the Netherlands. And so he had kind of, in a way, had been involved in running Kahn as an espionage agent and trying to benefit from it. The first thing Kahn did when he returned to Pakistan was displace Dr. Mahmoud, take over the program, and kick Mahmoud out, who then went on to have a very successful career building a plutonium production reactor called the Kushab reactor. So he remained very influential and successful, but he was a big fundamentalist and was very sympathetic to the Taliban and even, I think, al-Qaeda. And so he was the one who sat around a campfire with bin Laden discussing how to build nuclear weapons. And al-Qaeda had the smarts to realize that they didn't have the knowledge and they needed to reach out. Now, fortunately, that program by al-Qaeda in Afghanistan had only started about a year before these Pakistani scientists showed up. And it was very early, and it was completely disrupted. But we believe they've been working on it since, but we don't think the progress has been that great, but we don't see them stopping. And we see them persistent. And so I think the risk is that al-Qaeda will gain in its ability to build nuclear weapons over time, and it'll be looking for opportunities to steal nuclear explosive material or otherwise buy it on the black market.
We are at our midpoint in this hour of focus, and let me introduce again the guest, David Albright. He is a physicist. He is president of the Institute for Science and International Security in Washington, D.C., sometimes known by its initials, ISIS. He directs the project work there. Also, he regularly publishes and conducts scientific research. He's written a number of assessments on secret nuclear weapons programs throughout the world, has been cited often in the media, and appeared frequently on television and radio. He's testified many times before the Congress. Before founding ISIS, he worked as a senior staff scientist at the Federation of American Scientists and also as member of the research staff of Princeton University's Center for Energy and Environmental Studies. He is the author of a newly published book that looks at this issue. The title of the book is Peddling Peril, the subtitle, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. It's published by Free Press. It's in the bookstores now. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, it seems that it may be that the know-how behind building weapons is pretty difficult to control. So then what you have to say is the thing that your best opportunity to control the spread of weapons is nuclear material, and then the technology that's involved in producing that, and also then building and putting together a weapon. And so then maybe the question is, say, again, going to AQ Kahn, how was it that even though we have international conventions in place that are designed to try to limit the spread of the hardware, how is it that he was able to and Pakistan was able to get the stuff needed to build the plant to then put their technical know-how to use that and actually to make a weapon?
Yeah, well, one is, let me just start by saying that it's hard to see how you control know-how when you look at actual cases,
mm-hmm.
but it is possible to do mm-hmm. it. And it needs to be done internationally much more effectively because countries classify things differently, and so you may get a secret in the United States that you couldn't get in Britain and vice versa. So you do have to, but you still need to try to control the secret knowledge about building a centrifuge or building an atomic bomb. And if it leaks out, it's important for governments to try to get it back. I mean, it's... If it gets on the internet, let's say, it's hard to get it back. But even there, you can limit the spread. But often the traffickers hoard this information. I mean, they paid a lot of money for it, perhaps, or they want to sell it for a lot of information. So they don't distribute it very much. And so if you can bust up a network, you always want to try to get whatever secret information they have because it may not have really spread as far as you may think. Now, that being said, how did Kahn succeed? One is, the controls over the sensitive information, the classified information in the Netherlands, were a joke. And he exploited those weak controls to get it. He shouldn't have had access to any of it based on the security clearance he carried when he was working in the Netherlands. Nonetheless, the controls were so weak he had access to all of it. And so he was able to exploit those weaknesses. Now, there are all kinds of international conventions on controlling dual-use items that can be used for to build a nuclear facility or used in a nuclear facility, enrichment plant, reactor, or be used for peaceful uses. There's direct-use material, reactor components, gas centrifuges themselves are major components. The trouble is the controls have developed very gradually and largely in reaction to a scandal. So people learn about Kahn in the late 70s, early 80s. Suddenly there's now controls over equipment involved in gas centrifuge facilities. But Kahn's already bought it, and they're hoping, well, they'll catch the next guy. Well, the next guy, which was Iraq, said, well, okay, we now can't buy whole things, whole subcomponents of centrifuge plants, but we can buy the subcomponents of those things. And they went about and did that. And then the world reacted to Iraq, particularly after the invasion of Kuwait in 1990, and then said, okay, now we're going to control those things. And so what you have, unfortunately, is the powers that be are always lagging behind the smugglers. And so they've really never caught up. And now Iran, North Korea, Pakistan are exploiting the loopholes and weaknesses in the current situation pretty successfully, actually.
Yeah. So one thing, the strategy that smugglers have used is that rather than going out there and buying the things that they need and importing them directly to where they are, they move through a third country,
right.
And China apparently has been a source for that kind of work, so that it doesn't it makes the path from start to finish sort of indirect, maybe more difficult to track. And how do you deal with a problem like that?
Well, one is, and this gets into the solutions, because this situation is by no means hopeless. And in fact, probably the reason for the greatest hope is what we talked about initially, is that there are only 9 countries that, mm-hmm. that still mm-hmm. have nuclear weapons, and there were 30 that tried that we know of, maybe even more. So I think there is hope. Now, one thing that's necessary right now is China has got to enforce its own laws against nuclear black market activities or illicit nuclear trade. And it has the laws in the books, but its companies just ignore them, and the government doesn't do much about it, if anything. And so you have a situation ripe for exploitation by Iran and North Korea. And they go in there, they contact a Chinese trading company, a middleman. That middleman may contact a European supplier that has a subsidiary in China and buy an item. And to the European supplier, it looks like a domestic transaction. It's just going from one place in China to another, or it's going from Europe to China to this Chinese company, trading company. But in fact, the Chinese trading company smuggles it out to Iran or North Korea. But the government's not checking. The Chinese companies are not suspicious. They're more interested in profit than nonproliferation. And so you have an unbearable situation. And we regularly see cases that this is happening, and the Chinese government is just not doing enough to try to stop it. And it's very important that China be convinced that it's really not in its interest to have its system exploited so North Korea improves its nuclear arsenal and Iran gets nuclear weapons. And because these countries do not build anything themselves that they need for gas centrifuge, anything significant. They're going out and buying. Even, we saw a case where a centrifuge is run by a motor, and the centrifuge Iran has now has a pretty primitive motor. It's like equivalent to a vacuum cleaner motor. Iran went out and bought the subcomponents in Europe, brought them in through places like Turkey, and then a workshop in Tehran would assemble the components into the motor. So they couldn't even make these vacuum cleaner motor parts.
Mm-hmm.
So you have countries that really cannot survive without the illicit trade, and certainly can't build nuclear weapons without them, or in the case of North Korea, improve them. And so it's very important to try to find these gaps in the system like China and then get China to improve the controls. Mm-hmm. And China is no different than, let's say, Germany was in the 1970s and 80s. That was the gap then, and it was used very much by Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, but Germany changed.
Well, and maybe the example you gave before also suggested the difficulty of controlling the export of technology that maybe has multiple uses. And if you're talking about something that, like the motor you're talking about, yes, I you could modify that and use it in a nuclear centrifuge, but you might also build a vacuum cleaner. So the question is, how do you determine whether people are doing one or the other?
Well, that's where I think there's a lot of things that can be done. One that industry should really do more of is be suspicious, and some industry will do this. They say, look, our profits are not as important as stopping the spread of nuclear weapons, and we will become suspicious. We will have officials that look for these suspicious inquiries, or they seem as requests for prices. They may come as an email asking, you know, we'd like to buy this, how much is it? And these companies, and I've seen this many times, they know their technology, they know their buyers, and they can sense that this is suspicious. Maybe this is really Pakistan behind this order, or Iran, or it's a gas centrifuge program someplace. But the responsible ones will increasingly say, no, we're not going to do this. Now, what we've been advocating, and governments in Europe have been advocating, and also the United States, is, okay, industry, well, tell us about that inquiry. Pass it on. Because governments can then follow up and try to disrupt the network, learn about it, and then take steps to disrupt it. And so one way to deal with this situation is ethical, for companies to become more ethical, to understand that a nuclear weapon is really something to be prevented and is not more important than profit, and that they are in the lookouts or in the first line of defense against proliferation. And if they cooperate with their governments, the effect is synergistic in trying to detect and stop these networks.
And that it seems that may be a difficult point to make with a business where you're hoping that what they will do is do the right thing, but in the course of doing the right thing, they're going to be giving up a sale, and that's going to affect their bottom line.
That's right, and that's what, in the end, that's what proliferation has benefited from. I mean, it's unfortunately the case that, you know, if there was not a profit modem, countries like Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea would have real trouble acquiring nuclear weapons. And so it's really right at the heart of this. And so in addition to appealing to industry to be more ethical, you also have to have pretty robust laws that say, look, if you do violate the law and export to a country like Iran and you know it or have reason to suspect it, then you're going to face some pretty serious consequences. And I think the United States does a pretty good job at creating those laws. But as we talked about China, China doesn't have too bad of laws, but it doesn't implement them or enforce them. And countries, you know, a major, we call it a turntable, kind of a transshipment point, is Malaysia. They don't have export controls at all. Mm-hmm. Iran can set up a company there, try to buy things in Europe or the United States, try to deceive the suppliers that it's only going to go to Malaysia, and then turn around and smuggle it out to Iran. And they do it all the time. And Malaysia, even when they know about it, doesn't have the laws to do anything. And so you have a real asymmetry in export control laws around the world. And so, again, President Obama said that he wants all countries to have export control laws that are effective. And he made it a key part of his Prague speech, which mainly talked about achieving nuclear disarmament and arms control. But he understood, and this is, I think, is central to a debate on nuclear disarmament, is if you can't stop this illicit nuclear trade, you'll never get to nuclear disarmament. I mean, but if you can create the mechanisms to thwart it, to stop it, you will have a disarmament regime that is much more robust and much more verifiable. If you have companies working with government to sniff out efforts by countries or even terrorists, who knows what capabilities they'll have 10, 20 years from now, to build nuclear weapons capabilities.
Our guest in this hour of focus, David Albright, he is a physicist. He is also the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security in Washington, D.C. It's an organization that's interested in monitoring the spread of nuclear weapons, technology, know-how. He's the author of a recent book. The title is Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies, published by Free Press. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. We have a caller. We'd welcome others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll talk with someone here in Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes, two things. First, if you talk about Robert Oppenheimer and his ideas about proliferating the atomic knowledge, and the gifting, and I'm not certain of that I'm accurate in this. I don't see much in it, but I read about the gifting of atomic weapons to England and to Israel.
I'm not familiar with, I've certainly looked at a lot of what Oppenheimer did. I'm not familiar with his ideas of proliferating atomic knowledge. So let me not try to answer that. The gifting, I mean, is a serious problem. I mean, UK was part of the Manhattan Project and so benefited dramatically from the progress during World War II on building nuclear weapons. Israel acquired nuclear weapons as a result of an agreement with France to where they bought a reactor and a plutonium separation plant. And so those were early signs that countries aren't going to do it on their own, that they're going to depend on others to help them. I mean, and I think you could argue if Britain hadn't been part of the Manhattan Project, it would have taken them a long time to be able to build a nuclear weapon. Israel probably would have taken a couple decades longer without the help from France. And so I think what those examples unfortunately heralded was that countries are going to go out and acquire help from others to get nuclear weapons. And the nature of that kind of help has changed over time. Pakistan wasn't able to buy a reprocessing plant. Believe it or not, it tried to buy one from France in the 70s, but the United States intervened and convinced France not to sell a reprocessing plant to Pakistan and many other countries like Taiwan, South Korea. So, but unfortunately, the central problem is this, that you can't, we're not successful at plugging all the ways of, in a sense, if I can use the caller's word, gifting nuclear weapons capabilities to other countries.
Well, and I think one of the points that you make right up front in the book is that the reality of the last several decades is that those states who have wanted to go nuclear have done so almost exclusively through illegal means. And that also, though, you go on to make the point that you think that both governments and businesses have often, to quote you, overlooked or downplayed this path to the bomb.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and you may have good countries at one point. U.S. has traditionally been one of the better ones, but, you know, different times you'd have Germany that 70s and 80s, you know, said, look, people doing this are members of, you know, their equivalent of a country club. How dare you suggest they're helping Pakistan? So you had the governments protecting the smugglers. And so you've had governments that just don't care. You've had governments have actually supported proliferation, if you look at Pakistan. And so you've had a very unequal record. And the profit motive has been throughout, that it's been a very powerful motivator and cause of proliferation. And so it's been a sad story. We have learned a lot since then. And in the last several years, you've seen efforts to try to fix these problems globally. And that President Bush supported initiatives in the UN to require all countries to have export controls. You know, unfortunately, that hasn't been implemented well, but it's certainly the basis of President Obama saying that he wants to see that happen and to see these export control laws be effective. And so I think we've, in a sense, turned a corner that And AQ Khan's network and the busting of that network was a wake-up call. Because here you had a case where a band of businessmen, weapons people, you know, Pakistanis, were selling entire centrifuge plants. I mean, it was unheard of that that was even possible. I mean, sure, France could do it. Germany could do it. But, my God, a band of smugglers could do it. It was a real shock. And so I think we've now had this wake-up call with Khan. There's new determination to deal with this problem in the Obama administration. And so I think the tools to do it are in front of us. It's just getting those implemented and getting the resolve, in a sense, of the major responsible international players, and I would include China in that, to actually carry forth this plan. And I think we can all end up much safer, dramatically reduce the chance of proliferation, and dramatically reduce the chance that a nuclear weapon will go off in the future.
We talked maybe at the beginning about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and its the role that it has played in limiting the spread of weapons and getting us to this point where there are not as many nations that have weapons as maybe at one point we feared there would be. There are sort of two key parts to the NPT. One is that nations who don't have nuclear weapons now say, we pledge not to go down that road, not to develop them. But there's another part here, and that's what I think irks the nations that are in the first group, and that is the nations that have them promise to move towards eliminating them. And that is the complaint that a lot of nations say, well, we've signed on and we've made the commitment not to go nuclear, but you guys, Russia and Britain and France and the United States and China, you know, the declared nuclear powers are not doing you're not holding up your side of this. And, you know, so is there some relationship between nuclear disarmament among declared nuclear powers and making progress on proliferation?
Yeah, there's a lot of fronts to stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. And the health of the Non-Proliferation Treaty is critical. And as you pointed out, there's a bargain in there that the nuclear weapon states, acknowledged ones, there are five, United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China, will agree to disarm. And because the non-nuclear weapon states don't want to be, in the end, disarmed, and yet these others are free to do whatever they want with nuclear weapons. So it was an essential bargain. And we've seen President Obama come out very strongly for nuclear disarmament, but the progress that he's made is going to be slow, and that's frustrated some non-nuclear weapon states. France, China haven't come out, or even Russia haven't come out in support of disarmament. And so there's a lot of frustration that they're not doing enough. And this is going to reach a head because in every 5 years the Non-Proliferation Treaty is reviewed. And the next review conference is in May. And I was up in New York with other people at ISIS meeting with about 10 countries last week, mostly non-nuclear weapon states. And they're clearly frustrated that the Obama should be commended. But again, it's all nuclear weapon states that have to make these constraints, and we want to see progress. And they point to that, look, the treaty is 40 years old, and there's still quite a few nuclear weapons in the world, and they would herald and view the START treaty that was just agreed to by the U.S. and Russia as a progress, but there's no international ban on nuclear testing. There's no international ban on banning the production of plutonium and highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. And China says it doesn't do it, but it's a little unclear. Pakistan just started another reactor to make plutonium for nuclear weapons. India's going ahead. Israel maybe. And so you still have material produced for nuclear weapons and no treaty banning it. And you don't have any real plan to get to deep cuts in nuclear arsenals. So there's a lot of frustration. Now, on the other side, the nuclear weapon states, particularly countries like the United States, are frustrated that the non-nuclear weapon states aren't doing enough to let's say, have thorough inspections. Iran refuses to have thorough inspections. Syria has refused, and yet it got help from North Korea to build a reactor, and so in secret. And it was using these weak inspections to thwart the International Atomic Energy Agency from detecting these undeclared activities. And so, you have frustration on the part of the nuclear weapon states that there's not been enough inspections. There's too much of a demand for all kinds of dangerous nuclear technologies that can be turned and used to make nuclear weapons, as we're seeing potentially in Iran. We saw in North Korea. And so the tensions work both ways. And so there's a hope that this conference can resolve this, although I think the expectation is not that great anymore. But one has to worry that if unless countries do their part, whether they're non-nuclear weapon states or nuclear weapon states, it can weaken the entire non-proliferation regime and weaken the non-proliferation treaty.
We have just, unfortunately, maybe about a minute. Going beyond the states that have joined the nuclear club recently and then those where we have reason to believe their strong intention to develop weapons, then there's maybe a third group that, again, and these are in places in the world where there is regional tension, there's sort of a third group that maybe we have reason to be concerned about. Just real quickly, who are we talking about there?
Well, in the Middle East, I mean, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, you really have to watch Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, and Syria. I mean, they may seek nuclear weapons. They've sort of tolerated Israel, but not been happy, but if Iran gets it, it's just too much. Another, in North Asia, you have to worry in the long term about Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. Now, right now, it's unlikely, but if the U.S. changes and offers less of a security umbrella, if the countries start to feel threatened by North Korea in some fundamental way, if North Korea changes and becomes more aggressive with nuclear weapons, it may have a very corrosive effect in the long term. There's outliers, too, like Burma. They may be seeking nuclear weapons. It's hard to figure out, but they may indeed be after them. And so there's going to remain a lot of concern. And in fact, it just goes to show if one country proliferates, it creates a ripple effect that then cause others to want to do it, too.
Our guest for this hour of Focus is David Albright. His book is Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. He is president and founder of the Institute for Science and International Security in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
WILO programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, bulk foods department, and in-store nutritionists to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields is on Springfield Avenue in Urbana. Support also comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting its final concert of the season, Friday, April 9th, at First United Methodist Church in Champaign. The program features soprano Desiree Hassler, Mozart's 39th Symphony, and also two works honoring Samuel Barber's 100th birthday. Information available at prairieensemble.org. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That is it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.